Okay, so I'll start this evening's talk. And tonight I was thinking of talking about sensuality, sensual pleasures, and how to think of sensual pleasures on the Buddhist path. How do sensual pleasures fit into the Buddhist path? How do we deal with them? What are we supposed to do regarding these things? And one of the reasons I want to talk about this is that sometimes people think that sensual pleasure is something to be discarded, something to be abandoned, something to be pushed aside, something bad, something evil. And you have to sort of get rid of it, and you have to force it out of your mind, and you have to give up everything in life. And only then can you be a good Buddhist. That's what people think sometimes. And because they think that, what they actually do is that they often cause enormous amount of suffering for themselves. And the reason why people think these kind of things is because often they will read the word of the Buddha, and they will read maybe a sutta which talks about very, very high ideals, the ideal of the enlightened person, right? The awakened one, the arahant. And of course, if you look at the very highest of ideals, and you take the arahant or the awakened person as your guide, then it might look like you have to discard all sensual pleasures, because the arahant basically has done just that. But the problem is, you cannot become an arahant by pretending to act like one. If you just pretend and you just try to act like the arahant and the awakened one, it's not going to work, right? You can't just try to be like an arahant and then you become one because of that. That's not how the Buddhist path works. The way the Buddhist path works is that you have to do the practice. And then when you do the practice, that is how you reach the state of awakening or enlightenment or arahantship. That's how you get there. So if you try to be an arahant without following the path carefully, all you really will do is create suffering for yourself, and it's very likely that you will end up giving up at the very beginning before you even get started on the Buddhist path. So because of that, I want to talk about the right approach to sensual pleasures, how to deal with them, and how we can not cause too much suffering for ourselves on this Buddhist path. Now, one of the ways that the Buddha talked about all kinds of things in the Dhamma, he talked about things in terms of three particular categories. And I want to talk about sensual pleasures also in terms of these three categories. And everything in the world can be classified according to these categories. And these categories are the pleasure of something. In other words, the advantage, the good thing that something gives you. The second category is the danger or disadvantage of something. And the third thing is the liberation from that particular thing. And I want to focus on sensuality or sensual pleasures in terms of those three categories. What is the pleasure? What is the danger in sensuality? Right, very important. You have to understand the danger. Otherwise, not much point in giving anything up if you don't understand the danger. And finally, the liberation. How does the liberation come about? There's a very common category found in the Buddha's discourses to look at the world in this particular way. And it's a very useful way of thinking about things. And of course, the first thing that strikes you, I'm going to talk about the pleasure or the advantage of sensuality first of all. There isn't that much to say. I think it's fairly obvious what that means. But the first thing is just the realism of the Buddha, right? He doesn't say, oh, you should just discard this. As far as the Buddha is concerned, sensuality is like a lower kind of pleasure, right? He's already gone beyond that. He has much higher pleasures in his life. But he doesn't just say, this is bad, or this is, you know, you should get rid of this. What he says is that there is a happiness to be had through sensuality. And it's very important just to appreciate that. There is a certain happiness there. And that's why we pursue these kind of pleasures, right? If there hadn't been any happiness in sensuality, you wouldn't be pursuing these things. So it's the very fact that there's happiness there which makes them so enticing and makes us follow these kind of pleasures. So this is the first thing to realize. And for the vast majority of people, that's pretty much all there is, right? Sensuality is really where they're at. That is what the world is like. They want to enjoy sensual pleasures. And if that is all there is, and then you take it away, it's like, help! what is going on? This is dangerous. I don't want to follow this Buddhist path. All my happiness is getting taken away from me. What a terrible thing that is. And you can see why people panic if they understand the Buddha's teachings in the wrong way. It looks scary, right? What is life without pleasure? What is life without happiness? It's pointless. We all have to have some degree of happiness in life. Without any pleasure, without any happiness, life is largely pointless. So you can see why people get a bit worried about Buddhism when they see that the pleasures, that happiness is about to be taken away from them. And for a very good reason. Life is about pleasures. If all gets taken away, it all becomes pretty pointless. So there is a good reason for that. So the first thing is to recognize there is happiness there. And we need happiness in life. So we shouldn't just throw it all out and start living a celibate lifestyle, eating just bread and water, and not having any entertainment whatsoever. If you do that, you're just going to make the things very miserable for yourself. And what will happen, I will illustrate what will happen by a story from the suttas. The suttas are, of course, the word of the Buddha. This story is a story of the Lady Visakha. Those of you who know the Buddhist teachings well, we know that the Lady Visakha was maybe the Buddha's main female lay disciple. She was a very wealthy woman, and she was also very wise in many ways. And she would go to the monastery where the Buddha was usually on every Uposatha day. The Uposatha day is a full moon day, or the new moon day, right? It's very kind of full moon day in the forest. It's very inspiring. You don't see so much in the city. If you live in the city, you don't see it so much. But when you live in the forest, like we do, down in Serpentine, the full moon is very powerful, right? And you can walk through the forest without any light whatsoever, even though it's pitch black apart from the moon. And it's very inspiring. And because it is very inspiring, the lay people would usually go to the monastery on these days. And that's when they would get teachings, right? They would meditate together, and they would get teachings from the Buddha, and they would try to get inspired. And that inspiration they would take back to them in their daily lives, and then they would feel inspired throughout the week to keep them going, so to speak. So this is what this Lady Visakha did. She went to the monastery, and then she asked the Buddha, a very good question. These are the kind of questions which I think are really good because they're down to earth and they make a lot of sense. And she's asked, how does she address the Buddha? Bante, probably. Bante, venerable sir, or something like that. How should one spend the Uposatha, the observance day, so that it is of great benefit and great fruit? That is her question, right? It's a very good question. Okay, you go to the monastery, you don't just hang out, but you actually spend it in such a way that it has great benefit and great fruit. And what the Buddha said, he says how you should not spend it. And this is what happened if you cut off sensuality too fast. So he said that, well, you come to the monastery, you keep the 8 precepts, right? The 8 precepts are the standard 5 precepts for a Buddhist. Plus that you keep on the, you have complete sexual abstinence as well. So it's a very strict precept in that sense. And then you also have the precepts of not eating after midday and not using any entertainment and not adorning yourself or beautifying yourself in any way. Just ordinary plain looks, right? So these are the precepts. And of course, if you take those on, because it is a restraint, because it is an abandoning of sensuality, it's easy to go the wrong way. And this is what the Buddha was pointing out to her. He said, when many people come to the monastery on these days, what they do is they sit down and they meditate. They close their eyes. And when they meditate, instead of watching the breath, instead of doing metta meditation, instead of doing something inspiring, they sit there and they think about, tomorrow, I don't have these precepts anymore, so tomorrow I'm going to cook this, I'm going to eat this, I'm going to watch this entertainment. And the Buddha said that if you do that kind of practice on the Uposatha day, it has not much benefit. It does not have much fruit arising from it. And you can see that. And this is what happens if we move too fast away from sensuality, right? You try to go on your retreat. Try to give up your ordinary comforts in life. And I think this happens to many, many people. They sit down and you start thinking about back home, right? Oh, you know, maybe I will be doing this or maybe I will be doing that. And you think about the future, you think about the past. And to a large extent, it is just that. It's an indulgence in your mind in sensuality. So that is the wrong way. And it shows you what happens if you give up things too fast. So how should one then spend the upasatha day in the right way? Well, what you should do is you should focus on the spiritual happiness instead. And when you are able to give rise to the spiritual happiness, then the sensual happiness by itself, it just fades away and becomes irrelevant. And the way the Buddha explained this is that you focus, for example, on your past good actions, on your past generosity. And very often this is automatic when you close your eyes. If you are a good person and you feel relaxed and at ease, when you close your eyes, you will just automatically feel reasonably good about yourself. And that goodness you feel inside as a consequence of your good actions in the past, that is the spiritual happiness the Buddha recommended. So that is what we do. And that is then the right way around. So anyway, so that is just to give you some idea of the happiness that comes from sensuality. So don't discard it too fast. If you do that, you will just suffer too much. And the Buddhist path is not really about suffering. It's about happiness. And this is one of the beautiful things about this path, in my opinion. So having looked very briefly at the happiness that comes from sensuality, I want to discuss some of the dangers of sensuality. And I think this is much more important. I think we all intuitively understand the happiness. Understanding the danger is actually not so obvious. So the first thing, and one of the most important problems with sensuality, is that it is a type of happiness that blocks you from achieving the higher happinesses of spirituality. So this is obviously very important, right? If it blocks you, if it hinders you in achieving a higher happiness, then you can see that there is a problem there. We all want to move towards something higher. I mean, if higher happiness is there for the taking, isn't that what we want? I can't imagine anybody saying no to that. So if the higher happiness is there and sensuality blocks that, it is a problem. So how does that work? And the first way of understanding that is very easy. Usually, as a good Buddhist, you try to keep the five precepts, right? This is kind of the basic morality of someone who is practicing the Buddhist way. Now, sometimes the sensual world is so enticing that it actually is very hard to keep the five precepts. It becomes very difficult. And a classic example in our modern world is like adultery, right? There's all so many temptations out there. It is so common, so many people do it. It doesn't seem like the wrong thing. And because it is so easy, it happens. And suddenly you find yourself in a situation where it's just all too easy. It happens almost automatically. And you can't really think clearly. You kind of lose completely the plot. And then before you know it, you've done something stupid, right? And then you regret it afterwards because you realize all the problems that come from that. And this is the problem. This is the problem of sensuality. It blinds you. At the moment, you can't see clearly. You don't know what's going on. And then you breach even the most basic of Buddhist morality gets broken because of that. And this is the power of having the five precepts, because when you have the five precepts, they are like signposts, right? They tell you, danger, watch out. And they make it very clear to you where you should not be going. So very, very useful. But it's even worse. That is kind of that is one thing. But sometimes it gets even worse. People kill each other over sensuality, right? One of the fascinating things about if you look at the murder rates around the world, people killing each other, the vast majority of murders happen within family life. They happen between spouses. They happen between people who actually are supposed to love each other, right? And these are the crimes of passion. Because something doesn't work out right, something doesn't go wrong, something goes wrong, you actually end up murdering people who really are very close to you. Crimes of passion. This is the most common type of murder in the world. It is driven by sensuality, driven by our attachment to the people around us. Theft is the same thing. We steal because of attachment. We steal because sometimes when it is too easy to steal, do something wrong. Again, we do this. And it's all driven by sensuality. So here you can see the problem. The problem is that you're practicing the five precepts. You know that if you are a moral and a kind person. There are wonderful benefits to be had from being a moral and kind person. So remember that, the benefits from being moral and kind is that you feel good about yourself, right? This is a very essential and very basic thing about morality. You sit down, you close your eyes, and you have a general sense of goodness inside of you. You feel good. You have a sense of peace. Now, if you do something which is wrong, and I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about, even just one bad act, you have a sense of conscience afterwards. You can't really be peaceful. You feel unhappy about what you did, right? And of course, the more bad things you do, that tends to build up. It builds itself up until your state of mind is quite dark and negative. And for that reason, immorality doesn't work. So remember what morality does. It frees you from all these other mind states which are a problem. And this is why sensuality is often so dangerous, because it tends to drag you in the wrong direction. So this is the first one. And please keep this in mind. Sometimes it's easy to think that this happens to other people, but I am a very moral person. It doesn't happen to me, right? It's very easy to think like that. But the reality is that if you live in the sensual world, sooner or later, these things tend to happen to each one of us. It's just a matter of the circumstances being right. We are no different from anyone else. We're all capable of doing these things which are basically nasty and no good. It all happens when the time is right. We are in the wrong circumstances, having the wrong kind of people around us. So this is the first thing. The second thing, the second way perhaps in which sensuality blocks the spiritual path, and now we're going a little bit a step higher up on the scales, and that I'm sure that many of you have probably had some sense of spiritual happiness, some sense of maybe in meditation you had a peaceful moment where everything became very beautiful, and you've seen things in a different way. I have had many of those moments in my life when things are very nice and very beautiful and very peaceful. And I'm sure many of you here, perhaps all of you here, have had those moments too. And you know how beautiful that is. And those moments, when you think about them, they are a sense of goodness inside, a sense of peace, a sense of not needing anything, a sense of feeling fulfilled, right? That is a true spiritual happiness, and it's very beautiful. And when you see that, you know that this is much more than the normal sensual pleasures that we get in the world. And yet, despite the fact that we know that, we tend to often indulge in sensual pleasures. And sensual pleasures, they take us away from that. Sensual pleasures are always about the future, they are about craving, they are about moving towards something else. And they take you away from that beautiful state of contentment, of peace in life, right? And once you see that, and I encourage you to reflect on that distinction between the spiritual happiness, when you kind of feel whole, you feel complete, right? You feel satisfied, content. What a beautiful thing that is. And compare that to the craving of sensuality. And sensuality is almost always, there's almost always an important aspect of craving and desire involved in that. Except maybe for the moment you kind of get what you want, and then you feel big deal, and then you move on to the next craving, right? There's almost always part of that. So reflect on that, and you see that sensuality is an obstacle, basically, to those beautiful states that it's possible to achieve on a spiritual path. Again, the danger in sensuality, it takes you away from the beautiful potential of the spiritual path. And I think one of the things which is interesting, I should actually bring in some more of the suttas, the things, the way the Buddha taught these things, because I think it's always very powerful to hear how the Buddha taught these things. And the problem here, the reason why sensuality is so enticing, as I said before, it tends to distort your perception of the world. You become like intoxicated with sensuality, right? And once you are intoxicated, things get turned upside down. You don't see what is right, you don't see what is wrong anymore. And because of that, that's why you tend to go wrong. And the Buddha had a very nice simile for this. And this is a simile which is called in the Sutta, the simile of the fruit tree. And in this simile, the Buddha says it's like a man who climbs this tree. And he climbs this fruit tree, which is laden with all kind of fruit. Imagine a mango tree, right, full of beautiful, sweet mangoes. And then he goes up into this tree, and then he starts eating all the mangoes, right? And because the mangoes are so delicious, he gets completely heedless, intoxicated by the taste of those mangoes. So the mangoes here are similarly for the sensual pleasures, right? You get intoxicated by them, and all you can think of is the mangoes, and all you can focus on is the mangoes. And while he's up there, this other man comes along, and he has a saw with him, and he takes this saw, and he starts cutting down this tree at the root. Now, because the fellow in the top is so intoxicated with eating the mangoes, he doesn't even heed, he doesn't even notice that there's another guy cutting down the tree at the bottom. And of course, what happens if you sit at the top of a tree and if somebody else cuts it down, eventually the tree falls over. And the guy in the top, if he's lucky, he gets away with a few broken bones. And if he's unlucky, he dies from that fall, right? And this is the idea I was just talking about before, is that you are so intoxicated, you forget what really matters in the world. So you start doing the wrong things, and you forget what is important. And this is the intoxication of sensual pleasure, which distorts your perception of the world. So this is the first danger, and it's a pretty grave danger, you know. You can see that there is a serious problem here. And the second danger I would like to talk about, and this is the fact that sensuality very often leads to conflict. It leads to problems in the world. It leads to argument. It leads to wars. It leads to all kinds of problems in our world. And the first way to understand that is just to remind yourself that the world we live in, there is a limited amount of resources, right? And we're all trying to get hold of these resources. If one person gets more, it means that somebody else gets less. And we're always fighting to some extent, or at least competing over these resources. And you can see that in family life. You know, I mean, I grew up with a brother and sister. And sometimes, you know, you want to watch TV, and one person wants to watch one channel. Someone else wants to watch another one. I want to use the computer. No, I too want to use the computer. It's my turn. You used it yesterday, but you used it the day before, etc., etc. Or there is a maybe some food that is left over, and there's only so much. I want the food. No, it's my turn. And this is what happens with children. Or there's a toy that you want. And again, the same thing. Not just with children, but also with adults. Sometimes we don't get what we want, right? And this is a problem of limited resources. Or you go to work, and you are kind of, you know, striving to make more money because you want a bigger house, you want a bigger car, you want a nice holiday overseas, or whatever it is. Again, you strive. Then somebody else gets that salary. Somebody else gets that promotion. You don't get it. And then you get upset because of that. We're always competing, fighting with each other. And this is one of the problems of sensuality. There's only so many resources to go around. And the only way that we, for us to get that resource, is that somebody else often doesn't get it, right? And again, the Buddha compared this to what he called the simile of the piece of meat. And the simile of the piece of meat is the idea of a bird which has gotten hold of this beautiful piece of meat, and it grabs it with its claw, and it flies off into the air. But then you see some other birds. These other birds see this piece of meat. And when they see the piece of meat, they too want the piece of meat, right? Just like human beings, we see other people have a big house, we too want a big house. Other people have a nice car, we too want a nice car. One bird has a piece of meat, we too want a piece of meat. So they attack the bird, and they try to grab the piece of meat and tear it off this other bird, right? You can see this happening all the time. It happens in nature all the time. And then, if that first bird doesn't let go of the piece of meat, what happens? Well, what happens is that probably it will get damaged or injured, or it might even die, because the other bird might be larger or whatever, right? Because of limited resources, we're fighting over them, and it leads to problems. And this is not just a simile, this actually happens in real life. You see that in nature. You may perhaps think that the kangaroos are very cuddly and nice when you come to Bodhinyana Monastery and you see the kangaroos in the forest. Sometimes they are very cuddly and nice, but if you give them something, if you give them some nice food, then suddenly the cuddliness disappears and something else emerges from the bottom of that kangaroo. Anger, competition, fighting comes out, and it's no longer as cuddly as it was before. You see the big kangaroo chasing away the small one, right? It's not. This is just the way the world is. Very, very unfair. But what can you do? You just have to watch it and see it happens. And it happens too, of course, in the human realm as well. So we fight over things. But it gets worse. It gets worse because not only do we actually compete over limited resources, but whatever we have in life, because of sensual desire, we attach to the things we have in life, right? We hold on to them. We have ownership over so many things. We have ownership over houses, over all the possessions we have. And if somebody upsets that ownership we think we have, then we get angry because of that. You could see that. It was very vivid just recently. We had the fires up in the Swan Hills, or whatever it is called. And you saw all the people suffering tremendously because the houses burned down, right? And it's, of course, it's terrible. And of course, when you see that, it's natural to have a sense of compassion, because we can imagine what it's like to have our house down, burned down, right? Everything we own is gone. What a terrible situation that is to be in. And yet, at the same time, you recognize, as a Buddhist, you recognize the reason why that suffering is there is basically because of sensual desires in the first place. We attach to these things. And because we attach, that is why the pain is so enormous when it gets taken away from us. And life is like that. We never know when our possessions are going to be taken away. We never know when the next fire is going to come through. We never know when a thief is going to come to our house. We never know when the government is going to turn up the taxes and take more. We never know when a family member is going to demand something from us. There's always the potential, is always there for the things that are beloved and pleasing to us to be taken away. At the very least, we know it will be taken away when we die, right? When we die, it's going to go, at the very least. So the more attachment you have now, the more suffering you will eventually have, regardless of what happens. So you can see that attachment and suffering go hand in hand. It's impossible to have attachment without having suffering. They're like two sides of the same coin. As soon as you are attached, then you should think, whatever is beloved and pleasing will become separated from me. This is one of the teachings in the suttas. Very powerful teaching. That reminds you of the danger again of sensuality, the danger of attachment. This is what happens. One of the wonderful, the great similes again of the Buddha that he uses to describe this, he says that sensual pleasures are like a debt. It is like taking up a debt. Why is that? Well, this is just from what I was explaining now. Because once you take up a debt, you have to repay it afterwards, right? There's always a repayment coming later on. So as soon as you're attached to something, you take things up because of sensual pleasures, you know you're going to have to give it up later on. It's going to be painful. That is the debt, right? It has to be given up. And the interest, with debt, there's always an interest. And the interest is the pain that often comes with having to give things up. There's an interest there as well. So remember the simile of the debt. Sensuality is like a debt. Another simile which says exactly the same thing is where the Buddha says that sensuality is like borrowed goods. You borrow things and you have to give it up again later on. Exactly the same idea. Whatever is beloved and pleasing to you must eventually be given back again, right? So it's like borrowed goods. So remember that. Everything you own is borrowed, right? It's not really yours. You can't really keep it. Eventually, it will have to go back again. Eventually, you will have to leave it at the very latest when you die. So how does that feel? Everything you own is borrowed. Gee, that's pretty... That's an unusual perception for most people, isn't it? With things like that. But it is true in a very real sense that everything actually is borrowed. So this, again, is a danger in sensuality. Eventually, you're going to have to give it up. So, these are some of the dangers. And of course, what the Buddha says, and this is what the Buddha does. He looks at the pleasure of sensuality, he looks at the danger in sensuality, and then he weighs it up and he says, well, actually, the danger is much greater. And the main reason why the danger is much greater is because it blocks the potential to some extent for spiritual happiness. So what do we do then if we recognize that? If you can see that some of the things that I've been saying tonight, maybe there's some truth to that. What do we do? And of course, the first thing that we don't do is just to throw out all the sensual pleasures and think that this somehow is going to give us happiness, because it isn't. What we do instead is, well, the first thing we do is we just take these kind of reflections that I've made tonight. If we think that they make sense, well, that already reduces the attachment, reduces the sensuality to some extent, right? If you can actually see that there is a danger there, automatically you tend to loosen your grip on the sensual pleasures, because you can see that there is a danger, that there is a potential for suffering in the future. So that is the first thing to do. The second thing you do, instead of throwing out all the sensuality, is that instead you just start to practice the spiritual happiness instead, right? And what happens, the beautiful thing that happens on the spiritual path, that when you start practicing the spiritual happiness, and that happiness goes up, you start to feel fulfilled inside. And that fulfillment inside, finally you are getting the very thing that craving was always promising you in the first place. Craving was always saying, you will feel fulfilled if you follow me. But it never really works. Why? Because there is a vacuum inside. That vacuum cannot be filled by all these external things we crave for. But if instead you start to practice for the spiritual happiness, and you look for the happiness that comes inside of yourself, that comes as a consequence of kindness, of generosity, and just feeling good about yourself, but that actually fills up the hole, right? It fills up this emptiness that we sometimes have inside of us, and we feel complete. And of course, when you feel complete, when you feel the emptiness is being filled up, then the craving is no longer there. If you feel fulfilled, there's no need for any craving. There's no need to get anything anymore. What a wonderful thing that is. And this is what the spiritual path does. So if you start practicing the spiritual path, if you are able to change your attitudes, change the way you look at the world, change your ideas about other people. Before I started to talk, I did a little bit of metta, loving-kindness meditation, right? And the point of loving-kindness meditation is to learn to perceive people, beings, animals, in a different way. To see the good qualities in others, to forgive their bad qualities. And then you're actually changing your whole mindset. And that changing of your mindset, which goes together with kindness, generosity, and all these kind of things, that is what fills you up inside. You feel complete. Craving dies down. You don't need it anymore. And you can see that the whole sensuality, the whole sensual realm, doesn't matter so much to you anymore. It becomes less important. And that, eventually, is how you overcome the sensual pleasures. Not by throwing them out, but finding something that is far, far superior to those sensual pleasures. And what a wonderful thing that is when that happens. What a powerful thing that is. And I'm sure all of you here have already experienced that to some extent. So remember that. Bring those memories back into mind. Then it's easier again to let go of these happinesses, which always have to do with the future, always have to do with craving, etc. And then you are on the right path. You're moving in the right direction. And of course, eventually, in the end, when you keep on practicing this path, what happens eventually is that you get to a state which is so content, so beautiful, so peaceful, you feel completely fulfilled inside. And at that point, sensuality makes no sense whatsoever anymore. At that point, you have abandoned sensuality 100%. And you understand for the first time in your life that sensuality is actually completely opposed to the spiritual path in its deepest aspects. When the spiritual path reaches its deepest possibilities, sensuality is 100% opposed to that. And that is why the awakened person has given up the desire for sensual pleasures 100%. Why is that? Again, it's because sensuality takes you out into the world, right? The eye goes out to see beautiful forms. The ear goes out to listen to nice sounds. It's always about going out into the world, out into the future, out into something else. The spiritual path is about being happy here and now, feeling contentment inside of you, not going out into the world, but going back inside of yourself. It's the exact opposite of going out. It's the going in instead. Right? So you can see then, if you understand what I'm talking about, and you will understand to some extent if you have a little bit of experience in meditation, you will see why eventually sensuality has to be given up completely. And you will understand that as clear as can be when you get to that point yourself. Then you will see what true happiness is and what is the right way of practicing it. And it is not that hard to understand how this works already on a very basic level. You do something good, you feel good about yourself. That goodness is in the present moment, right? Because you feel good about what you are as a human being. And because that happiness is in the present moment, right here, right now, it makes you mindful, right? You become mindful because you are happy in the present moment. So happiness draws you into the present moment. And when you are mindful and happy in the present moment, then meditation happens all by itself, and it's very easy. So happiness draws you in to the present moment. Meditation happens, and the whole external world starts to fade away. So, ultimately, the sensual pleasures, in the end, they have to be given up, but it's a long, long way down the path. In the meantime, don't throw them out too fast. Enjoy them to a limited extent. Don't allow them to become obstacles on the path, but still enjoy them in the right way. And then, as you practice the path, you will see how the spiritual happiness tends to get more and more to rise up. And sensuality, by its very nature, becomes less important to you. It just starts to diminish, to fade away into the background, and it's not so important anymore. But ultimately, and this is how you can see, sometimes you will hear people say, I want to live in the world and enjoy sensuality and also become enlightened, right? I will also practice the spiritual path to its full potential and still enjoy sensuality. But it doesn't work like that. You cannot actually practice the spiritual path to its full potential and also enjoy sensual pleasures. Why? Because just as I now explained, they are completely opposite to each other. They're like perpendicular to each other. They're completely opposed. So when people say that kind of thing, and of course it's natural to say that, because we want to have pleasures in the world, it basically means they haven't really understood the nature of spiritual happiness. You cannot do both at the same time. There comes a point when you have to choose, but it's a natural choice that largely happens by itself. So, there you are. That is my talk on how to enjoy life in the right way and not make too much suffering for yourself and sensuality and Buddhism. Thank you. So, are there any questions or complaints or anything else you'd like to bring up? Please bring anything up now if you wish to. Any question is acceptable. So, anyone wants to ask anything here? Remember what the Buddha said, if you ask questions, you will become wise in a future life, right? So don't be afraid of asking questions. This is your chance. Lost it, okay. There was only one question that was lost. Yes, Chris.
Yeah. Bhante, you was talking about the way that we can get drawn out into the senses, and that's working against the work of the mind that goes back to the source. But in the Dharma, there's a conceptualization of the sixth sense, correct me if I'm wrong, which is the sense of the mind. And while you can be addicted to the stimulation of the five senses, the sixth sense being the stimulation of the mind, is it possible to have a suffer from a similar addiction towards thinking, random, unfocused thinking? And is that related in any way to any of the five sense addictions? In other words, if you're addicted to sight or touch or sound, you know, maybe in the form of, you know, a sex addiction or a food addiction or something like that, does that flip over and have an automatic momentum in the sixth realm, which is the realm of the mind and daydreaming and all of that sort of stuff?
Yeah.
Could you make some comments on that, please?
Okay, sure. First comment is, Chris, you will become very wise in the future because you always ask many questions.
No, that isn't. Thank you, Bando.
We'll see what happens. I'll see you in the, maybe we'll see what happens in the next life. Anyway, so the answer is basically, does the sensuality also flip over into the sixth sense, into the mind? And the answer, of course, is yes, it does. And this is precisely the problem that I want to kind of make at the beginning of the talk. When you give up sensuality too fast, and then you try to sit meditation, all you think about is sensual pleasures, right? Not always sensual pleasures. Sometimes it's other things as well. Things go through your mind, but it will be a mix. And a lot of that will actually be sensual pleasures that go through your mind at that time. And that is, of course, a problem. And that is just as much a problem as external sensuality, at least at that particular time, because you're getting a certain measure of happiness from that thinking, that proliferating, which is happening, you know, happening while you do that. So even though it may not always be sensual thoughts that you have, it is a kind of enjoyment which is very similar to the sensual enjoyment when you're thinking about things. You will see when people go on meditation retreat, one of the most common complaints that people have is that they're thinking all the time. I can't stop thinking. What should I do to stop thinking? This is what happens all the time. And the answer to that question is exactly the same as the way to overcome sensuality. You have to develop a happiness which draws you into the present moment. If you have a happiness which draws you into the present moment, then you won't think anymore. Thinking is basically an escape, just like sensuality is. It draws you into something else where you feel a measure of happiness of thinking about these things. So you have to learn again to build up the spiritual happiness, and that is where that sensuality stops, or thinking stops as well. So yes, it can be a problem with the mind as well, just as much as the five senses. It's part of the same realm, basically. Yeah. Yeah. Yes? Yeah. Okay. Oh, okay. We've got a couple. Okay. Anyone else wants to ask anything in here before we move on from... Everybody happy? Yeah. Everybody content? Yeah? Okay. Okay, good. I'm very glad people are so content. That's what a wonderful thing that is. Okay, so this is a question from Stefano from Italy. Why are the rules for monks so strict regarding sexual pleasures? According to the scholar Annalayo, they are even stricter than those for the Jains, which was a very strict sect. Since one does not abandon those craving till one is a non-returner, does it not cause unnecessary suffering to all monks who have not yet reached that stage of enlightenment? Okay. it can do, if you're not careful, if you are not wise and you are kind of stupid, it can, of course, sometimes cause suffering. Yeah, it certainly can do. But I think the reason is because you have strict rules about this because you are trying to overcome these things, right? And one of the ways I think that this works is that you learn to use your mind in such a way to minimize this kind of problem. So you learn to see the world in a new way. And in a sense, it's almost like on the monastic path, it's such that it almost forces you a little bit to learn to perceive things differently. Right? So how do you learn to, how do you perceive a woman as a monk? And this is one of the, I was actually going to talk about this, but it didn't feel quite right during the talk, so I left it out. But I'll talk about it now, since you have brought up this question. So how do you perceive this as a monk? And one of the ways of doing that, and it's a very interesting discourse given by the Buddha, and the Buddha says that the problem of being attracted to the opposite gender is because you focus on your own gender in the wrong way. Right? Very interesting. It's not about how you focus on the opposite, it's about how you focus on yourself. That is the problem, says the Buddha. So if you, as a man, you focus on your own masculinity, if you, as a woman, focus on your own femininity, on those aspects which make you a man, whatever it is, you know, your physique, the way you speak, the way you act, anything which is connected with your masculinity, if you focus on that and you delight in that, then you will also be delighted by the opposite sex. And that is when you get attracted to the opposite gender, right? So what that sutta is saying is that the way to overcome attraction, or at least one way of overcoming attraction to the opposite gender, is by not focusing on the masculine aspect of yourself as a man, or the feminine aspect of yourself as a woman. So if you go to the gym and try to build up big muscles to be, because you are really interested in being the kind of the real man or whatever, then your desires are going to increase, and your interest in the opposite gender is also going to increase, because you're focusing on your own male qualities, right? If you are whatever it is you're thinking about in life which makes you a man, if you focus on that, that will increase your desire also for the opposite gender. And I find it always fascinating when I look at some of the people in the world which I think of as having very high spiritual attainments. It's almost as if they have reached a state of gender neutrality. They don't really have a gender anymore. If you look at the Buddha, I'm just looking at the Buddha here, the Buddha statue, like this one here, and also many other Buddha statues, you will notice that they don't really have much of a gender, right? They're kind of very neutral there. It's not really a man, it's not really a woman, it's kind of almost like gender neutral. So, and that is one thing with the Buddha statue, and I have also noticed the same thing with somebody like Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm is, I think it's a wonderful quality, it's a very beautiful quality, but it's almost like gender neutral, right? When you are with Ajahn Brahm, you don't have a feeling of somebody who is very much one thing or the other. And when I look at him, the way he treats a man or the way he treats women, it's almost exactly the same. You know, normally, if you're a man, you treat women a bit different from how you treat men, right? And probably the same thing with women. Because it's just natural, because of that, you know, how things are between men and women. But with Ajahn Brahm, it isn't like that. He has kind of lost that gender identity. And this is what it's about, gender identity, right? You identify with your gender. And because you identify with your gender, you want to enhance that. And because you want to enhance that, you identify more. And then you are attracted to the opposite gender, opposite sex. So stop identifying with the gender. Stop looking at your mirror in the mirror and see, am I looking handsome today? Or am I looking beautiful today? Am I muscles coming into shape when you're kind of pushing those weights or whatever? And the less you think about that, the less you think about yourself as a man, and the more you just think of yourself as a being, a human being, that desire tends to fall away, right? It's beautiful. I think it's such a powerful teaching, and it's so counterintuitive. It's not how you focus on the other gender, it's how you focus on yourself that actually matters the most, right? A very fascinating one. So this, Stefano, I'm actually talking to you, supposed to talk to you out there. So hopefully you're hearing all this. So this is one way, as a monastic, you use to overcome this. You stop, you don't try to be, you try to discard those ideas of masculinity and femininity to a large extent, and you become much more neutral in that way. Another beautiful way that the Buddha talked about overcoming attraction to the opposite gender is to look at women as either your mother, your sister, or your daughter, right? It's also very powerful. How do you feel about your mother, sister, and daughter? Well, it's a friendship. There's nothing more to it than that. So you look at women in the same way, and nuns will then look at men in the same way, father, brother, or son, right? again, it's a way. And you can develop these perceptions, but developing these perceptions, it makes it a lot easier to live the monastic life. And I think the point here is that you are, to some extent, forced to develop these perceptions. You have no choice, because otherwise you just suffer enormously. If you have an enormous amount of desire for the opposite gender, if you live the monastic life, it's going to lead to enormous amounts of suffering. Yeah. So one of the things also that is very important, I think, is to remember that it is often a right time to ordain as a monastic, right? And very often that right time is precisely when you start to see the danger in sensual pleasure, and you start to understand the potential happiness in spiritual pleasures. And I have seen in my life, very often people, they come to the retreat center in Jhana Grove, and they have a very profound meditation, right? Something very different from what they have ever seen before in their lives. And that is usually when they say, I'd like to become a monk or a nun, because now I understand. I have seen why I should be giving up these things. Now I understand the beauty of monastic life, what it really means, right? So that is when people, so often it was the right time. If there's too many desires, it makes it very difficult. Sometimes you have to wait for the time to be right. So then you enter monastic life. Sometimes you don't really know. So what you do if you don't know is you try out monastic life. You come and stay at the monastery for a few weeks, maybe for a few months, and you see what happens. And sometimes what you find, it actually is much easier than perhaps you thought was the case. It is easier because you are taken out of the sensual world. You're put in a monastic environment. It protects you naturally. If you live in the city, there's always images coming at you all the time. And it's very hard not to sometimes give rise to desires because of that, right? But when you live in the forest, it's much easier. It's much very protective and very supportive for living a celibate and monastic lifestyle. So these are some of the ways, Stefano, that this works out, and how it is possible to live the monastic life. So I hope that helps. Okay, anything else anyone wants to say before we call it a evening? Happiness all around, yeah? Okay, let's pay our respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.